From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Actress and now director Maggie Gyllenhaal wanted to set her new drama, The Lost Daughter, in Maine, but New Jersey offered a better tax credit. So the plan was to shoot in New Jersey until Gyllenhaal decided it just didn't feel right.
And it was so interesting because, like, as an actress, of course, a big idea like that, something that crumbles everything, it's really rarely welcomed. And as a director, the response was, okay.
Gyllenhaal tells us about finding her power behind the camera, which is how she wound up shooting The Lost Daughter in Greece. And she explains how she found the courage to write to the intimidating anonymous Italian author who writes under the pen name Elena Ferrante, seeking permission to adapt one of her books. The author's response was unlike anything she's ever told another director. But first, some banter buddies join me to look ahead to what 2022 holds for Hollywood. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by two banter buddies, Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News, and Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg. And we are going to be looking at the year ahead. Let me start with the antitrust questions. We've got two deals hanging over Hollywood. One of them is absolutely huge, which of course is AT&T spinning off of Warner Media to Discovery with David Zaslav, who's going to be in the driver's seat should this go through, as they certainly seem to believe it will. And then the other is MGM. Amazon is acquiring MGM. There's been a bit of noise raised on Capitol Hill about both of these. I think Amazon largely because it's a tech company and people like beating up on tech companies right now, and many of them definitely deserve to be beaten up on, maybe not for this particular reason. And of course, I think the Warner Media one is going to be very, very impactful. So just give me your quick take, Lucas, on that.
I don't understand that antitrust case against either of them. If there is one, especially in the case of Amazon, it feels like a reflection of a broader desire to break up Amazon. And the most convenient way they can go about that right now is going after the MGM deal.
Yeah, I would agree there, except, you know, antitrust is political. And that's exactly what kind of people are there in the enforcement division now, are people who are inherently suspicious of these kinds of deals and may want to make a very public example of media companies, which tend to get a lot of attention.
I agree with Lucas, though. I mean, MGM was more or less a distressed asset with one crown jewel. A lot of people think Amazon radically overpaid, but so be it. And the Warner thing, I mean, there's a company that really needs a rescue at this point, even though it was the legacy company. And I will move to a prediction there. I mean, clearly David Zaslav is signaling his desire to be a good member of the Hollywood community, to treat talent respectfully. He's contrasting himself with Jason Kyler, who has been running the place, and to some degree with Bob Chapek at Disney, who has tried to signal that he's going to be maybe a bit more talent friendly, but got off to a bad start with Scarlett Johansson, obviously. So I think that the town is almost turning its lonely, scared eyes to Warner Media and David Zaslav.
It's one thing to say you're going to be talent friendly, though, and it's another thing to do it, right? So we'll see what happens when he decides which executives from Warner Media stick around or which executives from the combined entity are running everything, because he's known as a pretty loyal guy to his senior lieutenants. Most of his top lieutenants at Discovery are not well-known commodities in the entertainment business. And if he puts them all in charge, it could be a redux or something similar where you have relative outsiders trying to tell the historical insiders how best to run their business.
And perhaps doing it in a way that would be cheap or cost-cutting oriented, because that is the reputation of David Zaslav at Discovery. He drives a very hard bargain with talent, and he is known for bottom-line management that has been very profitable for them and has paid him a lot of money over the years as CEO. And are you going to manage HBO, who deals with a certain level of talent, in a way that is different from how you manage, you know, Dr. Pimple Popper or, you know, the people who are on TLC shows, those kinds of people that are not in the same position as the HBO talent?
I think he knows that, but I think he is who he is, and he's a very tough executive, and we'll see how that plays out. Let me just briefly also say, I think that something that Lucas brought up when we did the end of the year banter, I kind of suspect they're going to try to figure out a way to have HBO Max to be called just Max because of the brand confusion. I think there will be a lot of changes, and we'll see. Disney, of course, a lot of eyes on Bob Chapek. He's already made his mark to some degree. He realigned things. He gave a lot more power over the creatives to his longtime lieutenant, Kareem Daniel. And as I have written, he has got pressure from Wall Street to build the streamer. He's got pressure from Hollywood to be talent friendly. He's trying to figure out a way to do both. I don't think it's an enviable job right now, especially coming after Bob Iger. I would say that there is pressure on him to spin off parts of the company, notably ESPN, ABC, maybe load some debt off the books, make Disney a purer version of itself. Lucas, any prediction there?
He is going to have to figure out how to more effectively bundle Disney Plus, Hulu, ESPN Plus, or I should say how to program those three together. I think long term, the prediction is still that those things all get collapsed into one product. I just don't know if it happens in 2022 or 2023 or 2024, because the future of Hulu is entangled a bit by the fact that Comcast still owns 30% of it, and it seems like Disney's not going to buy them out for at least another couple of years.
I would agree with that. I think that ultimately all of these streamers will create one product. HBO Max or Max or whatever it's called will be the home of HBO and Discovery and CNN Plus and all of these other assets that Warner Media or Warner Brothers Discovery has, and it will be one global product that is positioned to be a Netflix killer. And Disney will have to match that, and they will go all in on one global product.
You know, when I was a little baby reporter, there were six major studios, and now we're down to a couple of two or three, counting generously, companies that look like they can, legacy companies that look like they can stay in the game. And we have much bigger players really starting to assert themselves, like the Apples. And of course, Netflix has been doing this for years, and Amazon. It is getting very, very difficult for the legacy companies. I don't even think we'll talk about Sony Pictures right now, because it's just, it is what it is. CBS Viacom, however, we saw Shari Redstone fire Jim Giannopoulos as head of the studio, bringing in Brian Robbins as the Paw Patrol guy to do something with the studio, yet to be seen exactly what he has in mind. Are they in this business or not? Are they setting it up for a sale? What do you guys think?
Yes, Shari Redstone will have to sell, whether it's this year or whether it's in 3 to 5 years. I just don't see a world in which Paramount Plus can compete with those larger streamers. So if you can't compete, there will have to be consolidation, and that's going to be a sale. I don't know whether they will merge with Comcast, whether they will be bought by Netflix, or whatever will happen. But at some point, Shari Redstone will face the music she needs to sell.
I do want to push back a little bit on the branding of Brian Robbins as the Paw Patrol guy.
Okay, my bad. It was a little too mean.
There's also SpongeBob.
This is someone who has, between acting, directing, producing, and executive, he's worked in and around the entertainment business for 40 years. He has relationships with a lot of different people. I get that he is not a tried and true kind of traditional movie business guy, although he has produced several hit movies himself. So I saw that more as sort of Viacom CBS trying to bring someone in who would sort of lean into streaming a little bit more. It will represent a change at Paramount, but I guess I didn't see that as quite a seismic shift, even as something like a phone company buying an entertainment company.
I think it was perceived as a seismic shift. What he has to manifest in some shape or form, and I don't know how much runway he has. Maybe that was too dismissive. He definitely has a lot of experience, and no doubt CBS Viacom was pitching it that way. But, they didn't sort of, when they announced the thing, say, we are in this movie business. They have some big movies, and someday they'll release Mission Impossible 7. He'll make Mission Impossible 8. He will have to reckon with that. It's going to be a challenge, and we'll see how he manages it.
The movie business has always been a very small part of Viacom CBS and the other studios as well. So, television and streaming are where the focus is, because that's where the money is, and that's what Wall Street cares about.
Yeah, and Hollywood is still in a little bit in love and hoping the movie business doesn't ultimately die, which I think is a big question, very big question going forward. What is the movie business? Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News, and Lucas Shaw, head of the entertainment team at Bloomberg. In the new Netflix drama, The Lost Daughter, Olivia Colman plays Lita, a literature professor whose hopes for a quiet working holiday on a Greek island are dashed soon after she settles into her lounge chair. As a large, boisterous family takes over the beach, Lita's attention is drawn to a loving but troubled mother, Nina, played by Dakota Johnson. When Nina's young daughter suddenly goes missing, Lita finds her and saves the day, sort of.
So she's not calming down. Yeah. It's been a weird day. We found her and then she lost her doll.
The whole encounter brings back long-ago memories of Lita's own difficult experience as a young mother to two little girls. As the days go by, Lita's past continues to haunt her in increasingly overwhelming ways. The Lost Daughter is written and directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal, an Oscar-nominated actress known for the film Secretary and the HBO series The Deuce, where she played a porn star turned porn director. Gyllenhaal's film is based on a book by Elena Ferrante, the anonymous Italian writer behind the acclaimed My Brilliant Friend novels. Before Gyllenhaal could begin work on her directorial debut, she had a daunting task in front of her. I am completely stuck on how intimidated I would be to ask Elena Ferrante, who has this rigorous, intellectual, unsparing eye on the world, to adapt something that she wrote.
Well, I wasn't speaking to her personally, although I really wish I could. I have lots to say about this because she just wrote this piece in the New Statesman.
Yes, and she's written something previously, which I think that ran in The Guardian.
Yeah. So to be honest, I originally wanted the rights to a different book of hers. I was really struck by Days of Abandonment, which I think is a near perfect book. And we reached out to the publishers about it, and they said, look, the rights are very complicated. They're tied up with an Italian company, and, you know, but they thought that Ferrante and I would be a good match. And would I consider reading The Lost Daughter? And I read it in a weekend, and I was like, yes, it's the same. Of course, the story is very different, but the thing that was appealing to me, the thing that was calling to me, was her honesty, her truthfulness about being a mother, of course, but also about just in general, I think, being a woman in the world. So what I wrote to Ferrante was still something I feel about why I wanted to do it. I said that I didn't know how exactly I was going to do it, which was true. But, you know, I had had such an intense experience reading her books. And I thought, well, what if instead of alone in my room, having this kind of all of these feelings, what if we could create a situation? What if I could create a situation where it was actually happening in a communal setting, like a movie theater? You'd actually be hearing these things said out loud. You'd actually be seeing them, and you might be sitting next to your mother or your sister or your husband or your daughter. That seemed like a really radical thing to try to do.
Well, let me just step back a minute to the decision that you made to direct. And I had read that you said in The Deuce you were trying to imagine being a director because your character became a director. And then you started to consider it. And the minute you considered it, it started to happen, which I thought was very evocative.
It sort of was like that. I mean, I think looking back on it now, I think that I was always probably better suited to being a director. It wasn't that it had never occurred to me before doing The Deuce. I think it was more that I hadn't really allowed myself to consider how badly I wanted that, because there weren't a lot of models of women who were directors. Obviously, there were some very brave outliers, and they had a huge impact on me. I mean, I remember seeing The Piano when I was like 16, and I'd never seen anything like that before. I think that men make really, really interesting movies, many of which are a huge influence on me and that I love. But I think women make movies differently. I don't think that's like some kind of objective truth. That's just my experience. When we're listening to ourselves, it comes out differently. So I didn't have much of a model for that, but I was always backing up against some kind of edge of how much I wanted to express. You know what it feels like to become a director at this point is like that dream. I think it's a kind of a recurring dream for many people where, especially when you're living in a small apartment, that you like turn a corner and all of a sudden there's like a whole nother room in your apartment that you didn't know you had.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, and that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like. You know, you're like, I can get into this editing room and be free. You know, I've been in the editing room before, or I've had conversations about a cut. You know, as a producer on The Deuce for 3 years, I was seeing early cuts of things and commenting on them. And it would be like with very collaborative, interesting people I was working with, but still I would have to write, and I'm sure they'll tell you about them if you ask them, like, you know, 3-4 paragraph long essays about why this image has to go or must stay. And I have to write it just perfectly, be like a little funny and, you know, articulate everything perfectly. You know, and I get into my own editing room and I'm like, this is heaven. I don't have to waste my time with any of that.
I'm the captain now. Yeah. And it seems like Elena Ferrante was very much on the same page in terms of, she wrote in The Guardian, we've been inside the male cage for too long, and now that cage is collapsing. A woman artist has to be absolutely autonomous. Her search shouldn't encounter obstacles, especially when it's inspired by the work, by the thought of other women. So she actually went on to say, there's nothing wrong with a man wanting to make a film from her books. That's a good sign, but she would not be acquiescent. As she said, even if he had a strongly defined vision of his own, I would ask him to respect my view, to adhere to my world, to enter the cage of my story without trying to drag it into his. So it seems that in terms of the feminine gaze or the feminine handling of the material, you and she were on the same page, but did she really just say, go with God?
Yeah, she did. And in fact, this makes me think I sent the piece that she wrote in The New Statesman to my two best girlfriends. And one of them wrote me back and quoted her. Oh, she says something like, the beauty of betrayal, which I think what she's talking about is the ways in which I made it my own, which is what yes. She asked me to do.
Yeah, I read it the same way.
So yeah. I mean, she gave me the rights. The one thing I have to say about this New Statesman piece that kind of broke my heart a little bit, that she basically said, yes, you can have the rights. And she said, it wasn't enough, this letter that she wrote me when we began the process, she wrote, to begin an epistolary relationship. I took that to mean she would have liked to have one, to be communicating, even if only through letters. And it is not that I did not want to have a relationship with her that way. It's just if I felt a lot of pressure, you know, I could just jot off an email to her. Yeah, it makes me want to write to her now. So I will, I think. But
it could be, yeah, the beginning of a relationship, but not necessarily in person, or maybe someday.
Maybe someday. That's really up to her. But that's the thing is, like, really at this point, well, I really appreciated that space. I needed space in order to know what my voice was, I think. You know, I was in the middle of my adaptation when I read that Guardian piece that you just quoted from, and it was really around the time that I think what happened with that was I had followed her path through the book in the initial screenplay, even though a lot of things were already very different as they continued to be still. But I followed her format, including in particular, you know, sort of the reveal in the film happened much, much earlier. And I gave the script to two people, to Amy Herzog, who is a great writer, and to my mother, who's also a great writer. And they both said, you have to move this reveal. You have to pull it to the end of the movie. Maybe it works in a novel, but it doesn't work in a film. And I thought about it for a long time. Not a long time. I was pretty sure they were right, actually. But what it meant was that, like, my script all of a sudden had, like, no structure. To move that reveal meant that the whole thing was basically, like, lying in tatters on the floor, which did ultimately make the space, all the cracks that created for myself to really start to come through. And that's really when it started to be hot, you know, live and really work.
Coming up after a short break, Maggie Gyllenhaal tells us why she's done with offering spoons full of sugar. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Maggie Gyllenhaal, who's made her directorial debut with the film The Lost Daughter, now on Netflix. The Lost Daughter premiered at the Venice Film Festival, where Gyllenhaal won an award for Best Screenplay. The Lost Daughter is a drama that explores the mysteries and sometimes overwhelming challenges of motherhood. The story is told through the eyes of Lida, a middle-aged literature professor hoping for a quiet vacation in Greece. When Lida encounters the young mother and daughter, she is swept up in her own memories from nearly 20 years earlier, when her own two daughters were little girls. The younger version of Lida is played by Jessie Buckley, who becomes increasingly frustrated as her daughters keep interrupting her academic work.
Don't hit Mama. You can never, ever do that. Do you understand?
Can.
Out.
No.
Out.
No. Get off me!
15 more minutes!
The Lost Daughter is based on an Elena Ferrante book of the same title. And it's the first time Ferrante has allowed an adaptation of her work to be set outside of Italy and in English. Knowing that she had free rein, Gyllenhaal set out to make the story her own, though that didn't go exactly according to plan.
So I adapted it to take place in a kind of Eastern seaboard, unnamed, you know, Maine type of place. You know, lobster rolls and boardwalks. And we scouted Maine, actually, originally, and it was great and would have been a beautiful place to make the film. And my producer was like, there's a 5% tax incentive in Maine. It will never happen. And so then we went to New Jersey, where they have a 37% tax incentive.
Whoa. Yeah.
But we were like, to be, you know, New Jersey was okay. It would have been okay. And it was moving very quickly. And we had a budget and it worked. And we were basically looking like we were financed with that budget. And then the pandemic happened. And we let it go a few weeks thinking it was going to pass over like we all did. And then but I had some space to finally think. And I think I made really what was my first real move as a director. I wrote another, you know, like many paragraph email to everybody saying, first of all, we can't shoot in New Jersey because the numbers are so bad. But more than that, it was never right. And artistically, I don't want to do it there. And it was so interesting because, like, as an actress, of course, a big idea like that, something that crumbles everything, it's really rarely welcomed. And as a director, the response was, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. And so then, you know, look, it was like April maybe, and we had to shoot if we were going to go this year or last year by, say, very end of September because everyone's in their bathing suit on the beach.
Right.
And so we tried Rhode Island. Then it's like we have Israeli producers, French DP, British actors, Irish actors, bunch of Americans, and there was no way to get visas in time for everyone to be in their bathing suits on the beach. Then we try Nova Scotia, still in this kind of Maine vibe, and Nova Scotia was like, please don't come here. They did not want us. They had no cases, fair enough. Then they said to me, could we go in the UK? Because the UK was getting back up into film production. And I was like, no, I don't know how to make a movie about a British woman on vacation in England. I can't. And again, this was like another real directorial moment where I listened to some unconscious thing inside me. I don't exactly know where it came from, but I was like, what about Greece? Mm. And I thought, I can be an outsider as much as she's an outsider. And that's how we ended up there. And it slid right in, the story.
I mean, we have to have a moment of silence for the 37% tax rebate, but did it?
In Greece, it was 40.
Oh, wow. I mean, did the budget turn out to be less, more, the same?
Our money went a lot further in Greece than it was going to go in New Jersey.
It was like a little island with like a population of 4,000 or something, right?
I don't know what the population was, but like because of the pandemic, all of our extras were, you know, the mayor, the owner of the Grand Hotel, the head of recycling, and they're in more than one scene. Like, you know, those are the kinds of compromises where I was like, I don't care. Yeah, bring them all back in. Like, those compromises I could make. I just couldn't shoot in New Jersey if it wasn't right.
I mean, really coming into that power and freedom that comes from having some power, right?
And also offering it to all the people around me, because I don't want to make people write 4-paragraph essays in order to get their ideas across to me.
That experience as an actor shapes how you approach the directing.
Massively, hugely, yeah. I remember reading something when I was acting, and I don't know if she really said this, but somewhere it says that Meryl Streep said that if you have an idea that you need, you know, in order to get your work done right, offer it up with a spoonful of sugar. And I took that advice, but it's a lot of extra work.
Yeah.
And I just didn't want anyone on my set to have to do that work. I mean, we treated each other with respect.
Right.
But just that extra kind of, it's a waste of time when there's no time.
So was it always meant for Netflix? Was that the going in, or did you?
No. We made it independently, which gave us just a massive amount of freedom. We couldn't even have a screening, let alone test it or something like that. It was pre-vaccine pandemic when we were cutting. Mm. But what it meant then was that we like never had a screening until we were in Venice. Never one time did I see my film with an audience until we're in that huge theater in Venice. But also that we really listened to ourselves, you know?
I mean, did you have feelings about a streamer versus somebody who will just release it theatrically and then later make the deal? Or did you feel like more eyeballs is good?
I feel like I don't have a totally clear grip on this, but I'm starting to understand sort of from the business side financially. But I'm really interested in the fact that Netflix's model of putting films out there has created a situation where a movie like mine, which is unusual, and it's art, you know, it was not made for business. And the intention was not get as many people to come on opening weekend as possible. That's just not the paradigm we were in making it. But somehow Netflix, because what they have to do is offer compelling material to many different kinds of people all the time, has created a situation where my movie, as unusual as it is, has actual financial value to them. It almost feels like the Medicis or something, you know, actually supporting artists because they need to offer that to a whole lot of people on their platform. So that's one thing I'm really interested in. And they treat us and my film with real intelligence. Like the people who work there and the way that, because yeah, they came in like late, you know, we were done, you know, the way that they have dealt with me as a filmmaker, considered the film, put the film out into the world, I have really thought was thoughtful, loving, and intelligent.
So are you, do you want to just direct from now on? Is that what you want to be and do, or are you just wait and see?
I do miss acting. There are elements of acting that I have loved, but it is not really where my mind is right now. I see that there would be a pleasure in just some brilliant director coming and offering me a great part and I could just sort of fall into their arms. You know, there's something appealing about that. But honestly, I find it hard to imagine going back to like filling the spoon up with sugar and, you know, writing essays. I have loved this, you know, it's been like finding another room in my apartment, you know, and I have also loved offering that kind of freedom and love to another actress or a few other actresses. That's been a major pleasure for me in all of this. So yeah, really, I'm thinking about what I'm going to write and direct next.
Maggie Gyllenhaal is the writer and director of The Lost Daughter. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.